This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Hello. Welcome to the Duke Ellington Sacred Concert Roundtable Discussion. My name is Max Whiting, and I'll be your host for the program. Our purpose for this program is to provide you, the viewer, with an introduction and overview of the life and times of one of America's greatest composers, Duke Ellington. This program is part of a series of activities designed to stimulate interest in the upcoming Duke Ellington Sacred Concert to be held here in Winthrop. The first segment was a musical tribute to Duke Ellington performed by my band, the Music Makers, at Ingleside Park, August the 8th. The Sacred Concert is comprised of music composed by Duke Ellington featuring Ken Hadley's Big Band, guest vocalist Paul Broadnax, Eula Lawrence, and Monica Hatch. Also, a 50-voice adult choir. This event will take place at St. John Evangelist Church Parish, the centennial celebration, Saturday, November 4th, 2007. And you're all invited to come, and tickets may be purchased at locations around town: St. John's Rectory, Elliott Whittier Insurance, IMG Gallery. We are very fortunate today to have with us a special group of people, musicians, educators, fans, experts on the music educators, and media impresarios who have devoted much of their lives. They've been involved one way or another with this type of music. They have agreed to share with us their personal stories and recollections of that era, the era during which Duke Ellington created his masterpieces. I personally found it quite interesting when speaking with some of our guests about their participation in this program. Every one of them was very enthusiastic about being a part of the program, and in fact, our telephone conversations became quite lengthy as we began to share some of our mutual stories and some of the things that we shared in common about the music. When Duke Ellington died in 1974, 10,000 people crowded into the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City to attend his funeral. Another 2,500 mourners who could not get in stood outside. The man they were honoring was more than just a famous bandleader and composer. James Lincoln Collier, an expert on Ellington, called him, and I quote, "the most celebrated musician of his era." At this time, it gives me great pleasure to produce Mr. Eric Jackson. I have been a longtime fan of yours.
Thank you.
And he's the host of the best jazz show on radio in the world. If you want to know about jazz, if you want to know about music and what's happening, you just have to dial 89.7 on your dial, and he'll let you know. It's better than going to school. Just listen regularly, and you'll be all right.
You're going to get me in trouble.
but I'm very serious about that, Eric. If I want to know what's happening, and there's a historical dimension to what you do, a current dimension, so you seem to tie everything together quite nicely. And the feedback I get from friends and all that is that they really enjoy your program
good,
very much.
Great.
At this time, I'd like to turn the mic over to you, and if you would just share some of your recollections of the Ellington era and the music, we'd be happy to
hear
that.
Thank you very much for a wonderful introduction. And I'm certainly honored to be a part of any celebration of Duke Ellington. I'm always ready to say a good word about this music that we call jazz. So it's my pleasure to be here. I grew up in kind of a Duke Ellington household. My father just turned 90, August the 31st, and Duke Ellington's music was the music in my household. That was the music that was the tops, the number one in the household. I mean, my father was never the kind of guy, or rarely ever called me in and said specifically to me, Eric, listen to this or listen to that. But Duke was just always being played in the household, and I knew that this was the man of honor and high esteem, even to the friendly debates that my father would get into with the Count Basie fans. He would tell, if you mentioned the name Count Basie in my father's house, you were cursing. Stop those curse words in this house. This is a Duke Ellington house. So I grew up in that kind of environment. My father knew members of the Ellington band and spent time with the Duke and the band. He, when Johnny Hodges passed away, I happened to be home in Camden, New Jersey, where I grew up. And my father and Cat Anderson, or I rode up to New York with my father and Cat Anderson, and they went up to go to the funeral. Cat was a frequent visitor to the house when he was in town in Philadelphia, where he lived. He and my, I guess my father and my mother and Cat and his wife would get together and go out dating. So I grew up around this music. It's an honor. When we look back at Duke's life, born in 1899, he had a career that spanned more than 50 years. And that is just incredible. Not only a career, but a career leading a band. For more than 50 years, an incredible accomplishment. Duke's mother, who was very special to Duke, always told Duke that he was blessed. That was something she told him. You were special. You were blessed. And Duke believed it. So it wasn't just something mother said and he just said, oh, Mom. It was something that Duke truly, truly believed, that he was blessed and he was a special person. A lot of people don't think of Duke and think of her religious life, but Duke's grandmother took Duke to church every Sunday, and they attended generally two different church services. One was the church of the father of his father, and the other was the church of his mother. And they went to these two different church services almost every Sunday. So this was a part of Duke's life. As a young man, it said the Duke read the Bible several times, and there are even reports that even all throughout his life, that the Duke would often come in from doing a gig somewhere and get into the bathtub and relax reading the Bible in the bathtub. So that this was all a part of Duke Ellington. But he grew up as, I guess, what you would call a normal child in Washington, D.C. He loved sports. He loved to play baseball. And he even tells of playing baseball, and a guy would come riding up on a horse alone and would sit there and watch the game for a while, and then after some time he would just wave and ride off, and that rider was the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. He said he would often come and view their games. Mm-hmm. Duke actually really did enjoy sports until somewhere in his mid-teen years he noticed when he went to see some live music that the girls seemed to like the musicians. That ended baseball for Duke Ellington. He became much more interested in playing that music. Duke came to New York in 1923, and there's a story told that when he and five other musicians arrived in New York, they were so broke that at one time they split a hot dog. They actually left after a time, went back to Washington, I guess, to regroup. And then they came back to New York City. The band was known as the Washingtonians, and Duke was not the leader, but he did do some writing and arranging for that group, but he was not the leader of that band. And eventually the leader decided to leave the band, and reluctantly Duke assumed the position of leader of this small group. It was only about five or six pieces. The group began to grow over the next few years as he started appearing in places like the Kentucky Club, first of all, in New York City. Kentucky Club had a bad habit of catching on fire. So Duke decided that was not the place where he wanted to play. I think it caught on fire three or four different times. And finally, Duke decided that was not the place to play. Incidentally, the Ellington Band did come to New England plenty of times. They played, I know they played in Salem, they played in Boston, they played in a number of places. There's even a report from a newspaper saying that Ellington's band had New England's feet dancing to his happy sounds during the 1920s. So you have to look at this picture of Duke Ellington, a dignified Duke Ellington in 1920s in America. That this is a picture that has to be understood, because we're talking about something very different. First of all, there were attitudes in white America that Duke Ellington had to deal with. There were still attitudes that said that black musicians were entertainers, and they wanted sort of remnants of the minstrel days to remain with black entertainers. They wanted you to dance. They wanted you to shuffle. They wanted you to perhaps even wear blackface. We know as late as 1938, they asked Billie Holiday to wear blackface in Detroit, Michigan. So in the 1920s, here we have a dignified Duke Ellington who steps up with his elegant attire, elegant Ellington, we could say. He steps up and starts talking, and we say, eloquent Ellington, when he starts talking. This is the man who came up in that kind of environment. But then look also what he also came up against. The Harlem Renaissance was also going on at that same time. Mm-hmm. In the Harlem Renaissance, there were those who said that the only way for African American artists to get respect was for them to recreate the music of European masters. So the only way that you were going to be respectable was if you played Mozart, if you played Beethoven. There were others, though, who argued and said, no, we have a great musical tradition. Perhaps this is coming from Dvorak's idea of nationalism from a few years before, where he said that there's a great body of music in the African American community. But this other group said, no, let's use that music and make a new music. Duke Ellington said in his early years, I don't play jazz, I play Negro folk music. So this is the kind of attitude that Duke came up against, these different forces that were existing in the 1920s. And again, elegant Ellington and eloquent Ellington. Just wonderful to see this dignified individual step forward. A love of African American culture, which was also unusual at that time. You can see that when you see his titles, Creole Love Call, Black Butterfly. You can see that even things like Stevedore Stomp reflecting the jobs that African Americans often had. So that here was an attitude about culture where many African American artists were afraid to be expressive of their culture. Duke stood up and proudly honored and depicted his culture in his music. The Cotton Club, where he opened in the late 1920s, sent that image across the country. Radio was extremely important in those days, because if you were a musician and you lived in New York or you lived in Boston, how were the people in Denver going to know what you sounded like? The record industry wasn't what it is today. They didn't have iPods. How are you going to be known in Denver, in Des Moines, in Dallas? Radio broadcasts. So Ellington had a radio broadcast coming from the Cotton Club, and that image is what was projected across the country. This dignified Duke was projected across the country. In about 1931, Duke left the Cotton Club, and he made a very important trip to England, played in England for a while, and he made a very important decision while there in England. He was deciding, here's a term, he was just trying to decide whether he should play, quote, serious music. Now, by that, Duke Ellington meant jazz or play some sort of novelty or pop music. That's what he was defining as serious music. He was going through this debate, but the reaction and the response that he got in England was enough to make Duke say, I'm going to play this serious music. I'm going to play jazz. And so he came back home and decided to play this music called jazz. In 1935, he suffered a major loss, a loss that sent him into a state of depression. His mother died. And Duke went into a state of depression and was actually fairly inactive for a time. 1937, his father died, and that was sort of a follow-up, but it was not the impact that it had on when his mother died. So he composed a work in 1935 called Reminiscing in Tempo, which was the first extended work in jazz, this work Reminiscing in Tempo, and it had a lot to do with the passing of his mother. He also did another interesting work about that same time. He did a film short called Symphony in Black, and in Symphony in Black, he did a sort of pseudo-spiritual called Hymn of Sorrow. Duke also, at other times in his career, took African-American spirituals and actually converted them, or Ellingtonized them, I guess we could say, did them in his unique style. In 1943, Duke Ellington started a tradition of appearing at Carnegie Hall annually. he appeared every year. He did a performance at Carnegie Hall. This again was a kind of a first. Benny Goodman had appeared at Carnegie Hall in 1938, but African Americans really had not appeared at Carnegie Hall as leaders of a project there at Carnegie Hall. And in 1943, Duke premiered a work called Black, Brown, and Beige at Carnegie Hall. And it was in this work that we first hear the tune Come Sunday. Come Sunday makes its debut in this 1943 work. Duke appeared at Carnegie Hall, I think, at least once a year for the next 5 or 6 years and did something. Incidentally, you can find a recording of that Carnegie Hall appearance that is available. And there's a little, if you read the notes carefully, you'll find out that the tapes at Carnegie Hall got slightly damaged, and Duke came up and did the that Black, Brown, and Beige in Boston at Symphony Hall about a week or two later, and they actually edited some of the Boston material in on that Carnegie Hall tape so that they'd have a complete performance. But that's in the notes. You'll find that in the notes there, too. In 1958, Duke again recorded Black, Brown, and Beige, and this time he enlisted the wonderful Mahalia Jackson to do the vocal part for Come Sunday. Come Sunday, of course, has ended up in the hymnals and Watts hymnals, and you can sing that along with all the other great hymns now. You can find that as a part of that work. In 1963, Duke did a work called My People as part of a Centennial of Progress Negro Exposition that took place in Chicago. Sad story is I arrived in Chicago with my parents. I was 13 years old, I guess. I arrived in Chicago with my parents that night. I don't know if I was invited, but my father was certainly invited to go to that performance that night. And we had just driven in from Camden, New Jersey, and he was a little tired and said no, he didn't think he was going to go. But we were there that night that work premiered. Speaking of premieres, in September of 1965, Duke premiered his Sacred Concert, the first Sacred Concert. It was based on a commission from Grace Cathedral out in San Francisco, and that's where it also was premiered. Now, it was not a mass. Duke was asked by Father Norman O'Connor to write a mass, but the first Sacred Concert, none of the Sacred Concerts were actually masses. What was actually interesting is Duke brought his music to the church. He didn't change his music to make it appropriate to the church. Duke was swinging like he always was when he brought the music to the church. And the first Sacred Concert is certainly an example of that, because the first Sacred Concert actually doesn't contain as much new music. It contains music from these previous works that I mentioned, Black, Brown, and Beige, and from My People. Much of that music in the first Sacred Concert contains those works redone. The major work that takes up about a third of the recording itself, though, is a work called In the Beginning God, which is based on the first 6 syllables of the Bible. And there's an interesting story that says Duke was trying to figure out the first 6 notes, what they would be, and he was a little baffled as to what they would be, and he called Billy Strayhorn, who was sick at that time and in the hospital, and Billy sent out an idea of 6 notes, and Duke had his idea of 6 notes, and they turned out to be almost identical. And that 6-note theme, Duke says, is repeated throughout this work, In the Beginning God. This is the lengthiest work that takes up, and the original work that takes up the first Sacred Concert. Incidentally, here's another missed opportunity by me. My father, as I mentioned, knew Duke well. I was there in the church when the work premiered in New York City on December 26th at the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church there in New York City. I was there during the day. I met Mercer Ellington. I met Louis Belson. Mm-hmm. I talked to a number of the other people. But my father offered me the choice of going to the concert, and my two older brothers offered me the choice of hanging out in Times Square.
Times Square.
I chose Times Square. So this was the, but that was the second sacred concert. Yeah, the first sacred concert. The second sacred concert premiered just a few years later. And this one is a different work with an extended, with much more original music. All the music except one piece, I believe, was written newly for this work. The Shepherd Who Watches Over the Night Flock, I believe, was not original. That was dedicated to the Reverend John Genzel. And it certainly is a work that had a life outside of this performance. Duke would often perform that work. This one. On this work, he called in a featured soloist from Sweden, vocalist Alice Babs, a wonderful soprano who was featured on this work and on the third sacred concert, which was recorded in October, just 6 months before Duke passed away, October 73, just 6 months before he passed away in 1974. Duke Ellington, again, at this time, the realization came to Duke that he had actually outlived that great band that he had. You looked around in that third sacred concert, none of those, or most of those great soloists who had been associated with the Ellington Orchestra are no longer there. It's always a kind of sadness. You know, every December I play all three of the sacred concerts in a row, and there's always a sadness when I get to that third concert because you know that that mighty orchestra is not there. But Duke, the master, writes and arranges knowing who's with the band. So he writes for Harry Carney. He writes for his own piano. And he writes for the strength of Alice Babs. And they're featured on this this final work. And the other interesting point, he also uses Art Barron playing a recorder. Now, what that brings to mind is during the 30s, Duke was known for having an extremely sensitive ear for recording studios. He would go into the studio that he knew would get the best sound for the band. Think about that. Here's a man who is now making these performances. Those concerts weren't made for LPs. They weren't made to be on records. They were made to be performed in cathedrals. And he uses a recorder. It's a solo. It's not even playing against anything else. Just can you imagine just the sound and how Duke must have been thinking acoustically to put that the sound of the recorder in the grape in the chapel? That was the sound that Duke Ellington was thinking about. So, you know, I've said enough, but Duke is certainly a master, and all the honor and respect that we could give to Duke Ellington is deserved and more.
I have a question.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question. Eric, what do you think was the reason for Duke Ellington's continued and success in the music world, in the entertainment world? Why is it he and not others were able to perform and continue at such a high level for such a long period of time?
I think part of it has to do with Duke Ellington as a composer. You know, when you just think of Duke Ellington, you think of so many wonderful compositions, and also, of course, Billy Strayhorn.
Yeah.
You think of so many compositions that were associated with that band, maybe more so than any other band leader. We think of other band leaders, we think of one or two songs, but Duke could do a string of hits. And I think that's the lifeblood of a band. He could, in fact, Duke could still, in 1970s, play some of his popular songs from the 1920s and 1930s because they were still hits and still well known in the minds of a lot of people. If you take even a Basie, Basie probably couldn't do his 1935 songs in the years right before he passed away, mm-hmm. too many of his fans wouldn't know mm-hmm. Those songs anymore. Yeah. Duke didn't have that problem. It is also because of Duke's success as a composer, really, that he was able to keep his big band going and mm-hmm. never had to disband.
Yeah.
Duke actually made an awful lot of money, and you can find mm-hmm. Some real statistics on this in a book called by Mark Tucker called The Duke Ellington Reader.
Mm-hmm.
He says a staggering amount of money that Duke Ellington had made by the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
But often the band didn't get paid enough at the individual gig to make the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
So that Duke took his royalties that he made from his compositions mm-hmm. and supported the band out of the royalties
uh-huh.
From his compositions, which again, only someone who has that bank mm-hmm. store, you
yeah.
know, that storehouse of compositions
sure.
could afford
yeah.
to do something like that.
Yeah.
And Duke had that, and that gave him the luxury of being able to keep his big band together when all of the rest of the big bands disbanded for a time.
It's been said that working with Duke Ellington was like working for the post office. You knew you had, as a musician, you knew you had a job forever and ever, as some of the musicians stayed with him 25 and 30 years and all of that, so that was very significant. Another point I'd like to pick up on is the popularity of his music. I know that I was an R&B guy for a number of years, and when I made the transition over, I noticed that if you knew the Duke Ellington material and you're going to play a general business job or a restaurant gig mm-hmm. or something like that, if you could play a lot of the Duke Ellington tunes, or whether it was Satin Doll or Caravan or some of those tunes, that you were going to be okay, because they sort of provided a foundation mm-hmm. of music that people in the audience would know, recognize, and appreciate.
Well, maybe that's that folk music quality that Duke Ellington talked about. You know, his music just touched so many people.
Mm-hmm.
It had a headiness and an earthiness.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was certainly some ethereal quality
yeah.
to the music,
yeah.
but there was always an earthiness
yeah.
to the music, and I think that's what people could recognize. Wynton Marsalis said something interesting about Duke Ellington. He said that Duke had the greatest amount of variety in dressing and redressing the blues of any musician he knew of.
Yeah.
So Duke always would keep the blues handy,
sure.
but you know, it wasn't always like Basie was much more overt, in your face kind of thing mm-hmm. with the blues. With
yeah.
Duke, you'd say, yeah, that is a blues, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
yeah.
I had occasion in preparing for this show to listen to a lot of Duke's music, and I found a CD, a compilation somewhere, and they had this standard that we play all the time called Things Ain't What They Used
to Be. Sure, sure.
And when you hear that tune played in this style, it sounds like R&B to me.
Right.
Because you had the shuffle thing going on there and the strong back beat, and they're really, really playing very hard on that tune.
Well, I think Duke, like Ella Fitzgerald, had big ears.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I think he was able to hear the, quote, contemporary things that were going on in the society.
Yeah.
And he was able to incorporate that to a degree that he was comfortable
yeah.
with in his music. And so I think you have albums like the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, where he almost sounds like a rock band
mm-hmm.
At times. And there are other things, but I think that's the magic
yeah.
of Duke Ellington. That was let's not forget that Duke Ellington's band was the contemporary band, was the dance music band,
mm-hmm.
and was the pop music
yeah,
band.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, he made a career out of hearing those folk rhythms, or the rhythms that the people in the street
yeah,
were dancing to,
sure.
and applying that to,
sure.
to his music. So, in one sense, it's only a continuation of
yeah.
what he was doing for decades.
Yeah. I'd like to bring in some of our guests here, Bob. Tyler. Bob is the older brother I never had. when I was making my transition from R&B and rock and roll and all that, and I had a Fender bass and all that, and I met Bob, and I was playing the thing the best I could, and he and some of his friends told me, when are you going to start playing a real bass? And that meant this big thing. I said, I'm going backwards, Bob. I'm getting older, and you're asking me to grab and play a more difficult. But anyway, I've struggled through it. But Bob is a very, very good friend, like a family member, and a wonderful musician and a great person and former music director at Burlington Schools in Reading, I believe it is. And he and his wife and a good friend of mine, Dave Matiavis on bass, formed a Storm Trio some years ago. They had a radio show and recordings and all kinds of things. And Bob, join us, will you? What are you thinking as you listen to all of this?
Well, first of all, I'm thinking I'm slightly intimidated by all this knowledge. It's fantastic. You know, I know I'm the older member in the group here, and I go back to really into the 30s quite a way. But unlike Eric, I never knew anything about this kind of thing until I was in my late teens. And when I did, I began playing the music without really knowing about the composers and especially Duke Ellington. And I hate to say this, Eric, but my love then was Count Basie.
You can say it to me, just not to my father.
and Charlie Parker. And because I became a bobster almost right away after my country music phase. I grew up with Roy Acuff and Red Foley and all those guys. And transitioned over into jazz after I came more in contact with my brother, who was a jazz player. He left home fairly early, but he's played with all the big bands, and I think at one time he played with Duke, and certainly Paul Gonsalves, one of his best friends, who used to stay with us. He stayed at our house, and he loved my mother. We came up north about 1948, and Paul stayed with us, but anyway, I really got more involved in the jazz scene then, and I didn't really appreciate all this. I didn't know all this about Duke Ellington. It's phenomenal. And I've gone online even and did research. And the guy was just absolutely beyond belief. His accomplishments were just staggering. And because Eric brought that out beautifully, I don't think I could ever add anything to it much. However, I didn't appreciate the Duke Ellington band as much, I don't think, as I did other bands at that time. I liked his music, and I played. I used to do all these tunes. Like, I loved Sophisticated Lady. I still love that tune. I'll play it practically every gig I play. Mood Indigo. How can you find anything prettier than that? But I want to inject something here. The idea of Duke, I can understand the man as a composer and his, you know, his driving force. Because I've seen some of that. My father used to take us. He was a photographer, and he used to take us sometime to churches, and I would see what was going on in the churches. And I heard a lot of different kinds of music back then. One, some of our churches would be all bluegrass music. And some of them, I'd go in and I'd hear beautiful spirituals and things like the Golden Gate Quartet and the Sedalia Singers. And I was amazed at all that. And it was beautiful music. And I felt fortunate to actually be able to hear all those things. And I think I understand the kind of driving force that could give to a person. I really do. And yet, to me, all music is sacred. Mm-hmm. It's a sacred development to me. Mm-hmm. Humans are a particular kind of species that has developed that. And no matter which way it went, to me it still speaks of something in our development that's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's the only way you can describe it. It's mm-hmm. awesome. Mm-hmm. So that to label a music sacred is like, it's redundancy. Mm-hmm. It's a real redundancy. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the sacred concepts of Duke Ellington never appealed to me as much as the music that I already knew of his. I had played, listened to, and enjoyed, and listened to Johnny Hodges play And my he's like our brother, Paul Gonsalves, play. He was an amazing tenor sax player. He also played great guitar.
Really?
You didn't realize that Paul was a phenomenal guitarist. He played, what do they call that? I forget it, Fogo or something like that. It's a Cape Verdean style.
Cape Verdean style.
And boy, could he play that. And a lot of the guys from that area where he came from. But I never felt all that impressed, as I said, with some of the things that in the so-called sacred concerts. Not that I didn't think they were very, very musical, but as on a personal level, they didn't appeal to me as much as I think they would appeal to somebody that had that more of that background. Mm-hmm. I'm just so impressed by this man, and I'm impressed with the concerts. I've heard the yes. I've heard that in the beginning, God,
sure.
and it reminds me of Muhammad Ali a little bit. it's almost like a rap almost about how the thing is going. It's cute. I think it's cute, but I don't give it any more importance in my mind. And of course, if people go see it and are going to be impressed and going to enjoy it because it was written for that specific kind of setting.
Yeah.
And when you write something for a specific kind of setting like that. And you've got everything on your side. You've got the acoustics. You've got the people, the expectations.
50 people in a choir singing behind
you. Yes, and great singers like Broadnax, who was a phenomenal singer.
Yeah.
I've known Paul for years.
Yeah.
And did you know that he was one of the principal writers, arrangers for the Sammy Lewis Orchestra, which my brother played with for years when he first got out of the... mustered out of the service at Fort Devens.
Yeah.
And he could join up with Savvy Lewis. Well, Paul wrote a lot of those charts.
Mm-hmm.
I have some of them, I think, parts of them at home. And it's been a revelation to me, and I hope I didn't disturb you with my own personal feelings there, but I just have the feeling that, to me, Duke's entire music is just great music.
And for me, Bob, because I wasn't very familiar with the concerts, the sacred concerts at all, I began to listen to them over and over, and Paul shared with me a DVD, and I'm listening, and I'm listening, and I'm trying to, you know, it wasn't what I expected, I have to tell you that. But as I listened and listened to other things that he did, I was trying to get this sort of, where's Duke coming from? How did he get to this point? And then when I understood a little bit more about the man and the spirituality part of it, to see that this is a place where he might end up, if I were to guess on this, because he was very, very, very spiritual in nature.
Oh, you can tell.
And so therefore, coming to this conclusion, if you call it a conclusion, but it sort of is, seems logical to me.
Mm-hmm.
Murphy Lewis. You were there in New Orleans. You sang with. Tell the story about your involvement with Duke and the sacred concerts. And I listened to the story and I was amazed because you told me you're a bass player. I'm amazed, bass player and all that. And they're holding auditions to sing in this concert. You said, I'm going down there to do it anyway. I don't care what they call for, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah, well, that was, next year makes 40 years ago. I mean, it's hard to imagine that long ago. But I had missed an opportunity to meet Louis Armstrong. My father grew up with Louis Armstrong before he was playing trumpet.
Uh-huh.
And when he was in town, my father wanted me to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
Bought me the ticket, and I wasn't into Louis Armstrong. And I missed the opportunity to meet Louis Armstrong. And so when I saw a sign on the bulletin board, I was in college, music department, I was a tuba major, that Duke Ellington's band was going to be in town doing the sacred concert. They were looking for vocal majors to come in audition. Now, I was a tuba major, and I played upright bass, and I was told by many of the vocal students there, they don't want any instrumentalists, they just want vocalists. Well, I decided I would go anyhow. I said, I just won't tell them I'm a tuba major. I went in audition, and it turns out I was selected to sing in the choir, and the vocalists were not. But I brought the program that from that concert in '68. And Interestingly, Duke Ellington, in the introduction, this is the sacred concert that was done at that time at the Municipal Auditorium. I thought it amazing, first of all, just rehearsing. The rehearsal was more exciting than the performance because I had a chance to see how they reacted with each other. And I even had the opportunity afterwards to get the signatures of most all of the band members. Cat Anderson, as you mentioned, and Cootie Williams, and
that ought to be worth Larry, a little something.
That's Mercy Ellington, yeah. And so it was quite an opportunity. But in the introduction, Duke Ellington speaks about the question was raised about his spirituality in terms of writing this.
Yeah.
And he said people many times ask him, you know, why did he write this? And what he said, I'll just quote what he said. He says, "I have done so not as a matter of career, but in response to a growing understanding of my own vocation," which says that he felt it as almost like a calling, you know, to do this. And, you know, music has a certain spirituality about itself, or any form of creativity. And when anyone gets so much involved, as much as Duke Ellington did, as we look in his autobiography, it's just amazing the number of compositions that he wrote. For instance, in 1967, he wrote 52 compositions. That's like one composition every week. Hmm. And then, but he was consistent, not just that in 66, he wrote 16, but that was the time he was writing a lot of music for the sacred. He wrote 40 compositions in 64, 42 in 63, 40 compositions in 1961. I didn't write down all of them, but he was doing this so consistently over such a long period of time. And I think when a person is so much involved in the arts in that way, you automatically get in touch with the spirituality of it. You realize this is not all from me. It's coming from a greater source. And I think that's what happened, as you say, that all the music is sacred. Sometimes people used to classify, jazz, that's worldly music and all that. Jazz is a classical form of music, just like a sonata, Beethoven's
Absolutely.
Sonata. It's a form of music, and in many ways, some of the pieces are what we call absolute music, which not necessarily telling a story about this, that, or the other, but it's music that's just coming from within.
Yes.
But I'd like to share an experience with this concert, because after the concert was over, I thought everyone had gone. I was on the piano trying to play one of his pieces, Something About Believing. And as I was trying, I couldn't get this chord that I was trying to get. And the next thing I knew, his two hands came over my shoulder. He said, "Oh, that's not the way it goes." He said, "This is the chord." And then he said, "Move to the side of the bench." And this dude came to show me how to play this piece. And I remember saying to myself, being a music student, thought maybe I can impress him by telling him, "Oh, that's a B-flat 7, you know, with a raised 11. And he said to me, "I don't think of it that way." He said, "I think of it as the sounds I want." He said, "I'm dealing with sounds. And I don't have time to start analyzing what the chord is. I'm dealing with my sounds," you know. He said, "So that's the way I look at it. Now, if somebody else were to come in and call it this, that, and the other," he said, "that's okay." But I thought what was interesting that he took the time to show me how to play this piece, which says to me about what he might think about music education. Yeah. And I bring that up because I've been a teacher in Boston now for, this will be my 38th year, and I think, were he alive today, and even when he was then, he would be interested in education, and how educating young people about this form of music, and I think that it's important that the schools address that. When I served as the music director for the Boston Public Schools for 4 years, I managed to organize an honors jazz band. I thought that, well, with 23 high schools, there must be, even if it's one kid from each high school, there must be enough to make up a band. Mm-hmm. And we did form a very good jazz band. Didn't last that long, unfortunately, but they were excellent. We picked the best students from each school, and Tito Puente performed with us shortly before he died, in fact, with the band. And unfortunately, when I was no longer music director, the funds were taken from it, the program, and so we're back to step one, I guess, with that. But I think it's important that schools recognize that, you know. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think that Duke Ellington, his music, I've been so impressed at how much he wrote over such a long period of time, and those large numbers of compositions. Yeah. You go all the way back to 1943, he was doing the same thing back then. In 1943, 1942, he wrote 40 compositions. On average, I'd say maybe 40 or 50 compositions every year. Mm-hmm. And that's just a tremendous amount of, he must have been composing like, I mean, because he also performed, he did a lot of performing different places. Yeah. And he must have had time to rehearse. Mm. So it just makes you think that he must have been really just so much saturated into it, you know.
Well, it looks like it's the right title for the book, Music is My Mistress.
Yeah.
You're answering the call to music all the time, right?
I think he wrote over 2,000 pieces. And in addition to the fact that he wrote ballets and mm-hmm. other kinds of works, but I think he wrote over 2,000 pieces in the course of his career, things that I guess we would call songs.
Yeah.
And then there are the ballet scores and all of that that he wrote. As far as rehearsing, though, we also know that Duke would rehearse on the bandstand. And in fact, a lot of times would baffle dancers mm-hmm. because Duke would be working on a new piece and just decide he wanted to hear the band play it, mm-hmm. and he would have the band play a piece, and the dancers would be like, what do I do with this? That would be, it was just Duke wanted to hear this piece. Yeah. The band was playing, and so mm-hmm. he would call out that piece for them to play mm-hmm. at that particular time. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so I wanted to comment on, too. You said appeared with Duke in the Sacred Concert at mm-hmm. the Municipal Auditorium.
Yeah.
There's a bit of irony there. The Municipal Auditorium sits in Louis Armstrong Park, right?
Right near the river.
Louis Armstrong Park and the actually one of the walls of the Municipal Auditorium actually face over an area known as Congo Square.
That's mm-hmm. right, yeah.
Now, when I was there in New Orleans maybe 10 years ago, mm-hmm. there was not a plaque, not a sign, mm-hmm. yeah. not a marquee, marking Congo Square.
Right, yeah. right.
Congo Square is perhaps one of the most important musical spots in the United States, if not in the world.
That's right.
It was a spot where the slaves were allowed to gather on Sundays mm-hmm. and play their music. Mm-hmm. It's the spot where they say that many of those African rhythms were kept alive, mm-hmm. where they were not allowed to be played on drums or songs, mm-hmm. not even allowed to be sung openly mm-hmm. in other places in the States. Right there in Congo Square, right. that music stayed alive, those rhythms stayed alive. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very important point. I asked a park guard that I saw wandering around, isn't there a plaque? Is there something here? She said, I've been working here for a while and I've never seen one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but I just wanted to mention that, because the irony was, I think on the wall above of the Municipal Auditorium, on the outside wall, it says something like music, art, dance, and drama. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and there certainly was music, art, dance, and drama here, and nothing is marking that spot.
Yeah. What you mentioned music education in the schools, Murph, and, mm-hmm. and Bob, you spent a lot of time in the school systems training musicians and bands and so forth and so on. Yeah. what's going on? What are your thoughts about that? How was it when you were doing it? What's going on now? Because to me, music in the schools is a major part of the curriculum, and the music that lives is the music that's promulgated through school systems and other places, but certainly a place where a young person without many means can get instruction, get a band instrument, and really get a foothold on playing some music.
Sure. The music in schools, to me, its importance is more than just developing performers, however.
Mm-hmm.
But we do develop performance. I have kids that'll come back to me now from years and years ago who are out playing or who are out singing. I had one kid that I had in a chorus, and I had to be very, very patient with this boy because I don't know if you ever heard the word 10 ear. I personally, as a teacher, never believed in that. I never believed that there's such a thing, because in order, if you have a 10-ear, you can't speak with an expression. Mm-hmm. You couldn't. I mean, you, everything would be monotone. You'd be speaking like a computer. Mm-hmm. And this boy, I stuck with him, and I even had him in. I put on several performances of Giancarlo Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors, which is a beautiful little one-act opera. And I had him as the page. And boy, when he came on, he had to announce thief, thief. Mm-hmm. If sometimes he'd get it on pitch, and most times no. Well, the last I heard of this boy, he was singing opera. It awakened something in him that made him go on and on and on. And he did learn to sing on pitch. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he even tried out for a district a couple mm-hmm. of times. He didn't make it because he wasn't quite up to it. Mm-hmm. But I keep getting those people. But that's not the important thing. Everybody that takes that music, and I'm hoping that it infuses itself in all the students, it adds something to their lives that's different, mm-hmm. that's special. Mm-hmm. And it can also enhance, to me, it can enhance the learning experience mm-hmm. to the point where it actually increases their ability mm-hmm. to learn. Mm-hmm. I've seen that. And I've worked with the kids throughout, from elementary through high school, even into college. Mm-hmm. And I even worked with the special needs kids mm-hmm. and sure. kids with problems with perception. Mm-hmm. And you had to develop techniques to reorient their thinking processes mm-hmm. with all kinds of little things, like walking on a beam, mm-hmm. playing with Cuisinart rods, mm-hmm. doing, repeating drum beats, mm-hmm. repeating phrases, musical phrases, and all that stuff helped them to learn, and they got so they could get into the regular curriculum, mm-hmm. special needs kids. So to me, it's a double force. By the way, I had two or three stage bands, and a couple of them went to Berkeley. We have a thing down at Berkeley School every year mm-hmm. Where the stage bands perform. Right. And I had a couple of bands into that. And that it was great. I'll never forget the time one of my little kiddos in that rainy day went up on the high trumpet and went up and hit that high E. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Seiko's eyes almost popped out of his head. It was great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun. It was fun teaching, wasn't it? Did you have fun teaching?
Yes. I think that, but there's still a shortage, a lack of music. Right, for instance, at the middle school level, it's required that students have 3 semesters of the arts. Now that's over the 3 years in middle school. So 3 semesters of the arts mean that if they took a drawing class and maybe one music class and one other thing, then that they have sufficiently completed the requirements. Now that's not much, and that's not just, okay. Let's say in those 3 years they won't have many opportunities to learn instrumental music or vocal. And in 1993, the Boston Public Schools, every instrumental teacher were made to be general music teachers.
Yeah.
And it totally got rid of the instrumental program.
Oh, boy.
So we had colleges like Berkeley trying to get students.
Yeah.
Students who would get in there couldn't stay in there because they didn't have any background training, you know. Mm-hmm. And I knew of some very, very good instrumental teachers who were assigned to an elementary school, almost babysitting, not using the talents that they have, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, in the business world, if a person has a great talent in some area, they make sure they're utilized. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen in the public schools. You know, we all, and not until some years later did we begin to take some of those instrumental teachers mm-hmm. and then assign them to one or two schools.
Yeah.
When I was teaching instrumental, I taught in 8 schools. For a period of 8 years. 1 year I had 12 schools. Mm-hmm. I would get up not sure which school I'm supposed to be at because I had to go to so many trying to have a band in 12 schools.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the priority, and studies have shown that students who take music, they excel in many other areas, in math, in reading. It helps their reading, the eye movement of the eyes and reading. It helps. I had a student in the middle school who he was in special ed. He was on a second grade reading level because of, you know, his disability. But I was able to use a song. He sang from my graduation. I picked him out as the soloist. He sang the song, I Believe. But we were able to take the words from that song, and for months that was his vocabulary list. And music breaks it down into syllables, so it helped him to learn to read because it's syllabically, you know, how it's written.
Sure.
So there are many benefits. I think people know that. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I mean, music helps. You can learn about mathematics.
Yeah.
And but I've always taken the point that music is good because music is good. Now, if it happens to help math and all these other subjects, that's great too. Mm-hmm. But too many times they reduce it to saying, well, you know, these other things. But I try to say, well, let's keep it at the top level, that music is important because music is important. It has its own intrinsic value.
Right, right, right.
And I think when we begin to think in that way, you know, the school should begin to do that. And they want to raise their scores, you know, bringing music in would really help them, these young. Yeah. They learn discipline. They learn how to, if you're going to practice, you have to discipline your time. How much time am I going to spend this? If I'm going to be pulled out of a class, I have to keep up with my other classes. So there are many things they learn in the process.
How are you going to work in harmony with other people?
Right.
How are you going to work together with people, which is a very important thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry. But I was going to say, and jazz is just one phase of that. You know, we try to teach the whole aspect. But when there's very little time to even teach even the basics, you know, like reading notes and things like that, they're being shortchanged from the cultural side of it. They're not learning, except for what the students hear on the radio, on TV, and that's the current thing for them. That's mostly what they're absorbed into.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to try to expose them to a broader.
Yeah.
Don't you find, though, that different systems treat the thing differently? For example, I'll look at different towns that I've worked with in the when I was doing adjudication for district and stuff like that. Different towns would treat it in a different manner, and in fact, the best students, the more advanced students, tend to come from certain towns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is over and over, and those are the towns that would either allocate the money or whatever it was to provide the teaching, and they would do it, and they would have the crack stage bands, the phenomenal stage bands. They would go to these contests and win all of the things.
Yeah.
Their kids would go to Berkeley or they'd go to North Texas State or wherever, you know, all these great schools. Juilliard.
Yeah.
So it does have, I think, the mindset of those who are in administrative roles or those who make those decisions. But I think the communities too has a voice to say it, because people are elected by, you know, the constituents. But like when I grew up in New Orleans, we had music. Every high school had at least a marching band, a jazz band, and a concert band, and that was just standard. And every school, pretty much every school had that. I don't know of any. And now, you know, and I when I came to Boston, I really was expecting to see that kind of a thing. I was very much involved in marching bands, and when I came to Boston thinking, well, maybe I can do some of this. And I was kind of surprised when I was teaching at one of my schools in Columbia Point, and I heard from the distance sounds of marching band, you know, and I said, oh, gee whiz. And then when I realized, It was at UMass, they had a game. It was being music playing over the loudspeaker.
Oh.
It was not a live band.
Oh.
And I said to myself, you know, the city of Boston should not have to import bands from outside when they're going to have the Dorchester Day Parade. And the city of Boston should have some participation when you see the Macy's Day Parade on the TV. And it's unfortunate, with the size of the number of schools we have, you know, so it's something that really there should be a strong advocacy to make that happen, you know, I think.
One of the things I hope we accomplish here today is that by taking a look at the Duke Ellington Sacred Concerts and the development of this music and the other aspects of music like music education, that we're able to stimulate some thinking about the importance of music and the importance of coming together. Here we have an event which takes into account a big band, a big choir, singers, dancers, and if you talk about working together, if you talk about working in harmony, if you talk about discipline, if you talk about all of these people coming together over a prolonged period of time in order to create this product, isn't this exactly what we want to do in the school system, mm-hmm. Have kids come together, take this different pieces of a project and work on it. I didn't take music in school, but I was an athletic. But I thought that in athletics we achieve some of the same kinds of things. Teamwork and respect for one another, differentiation in terms of tasks and all those kinds of things. So I have a desire that putting these concerts on and so forth helps to stimulate a town, a group of people to recognize how wonderful music can be. And this kind of thing is certainly a grand idea that I think is still important. I've always, when I go south, oftentimes I met a fellow playing on the street, guitar player, and I began to talk with him. And as a bass player, I said, "Well, give me something to do." So I brought up my bass and we started playing on the street. Come to find out, he's the music director for a church. So now he brings me to church, and I find out that Sunday morning I got to go to church to play music, you know, because I didn't have a gig. So I figured, well, what the hell, I might as well play some music somewhere. So I'm playing in the church, you know, and it was swinging. We did a nice concert last year. We had goongas and a couple of horns and things, and we traveled on to Pompano Beach and places like that, playing spirituals and gospel music. Right. Yeah,
that's music.
You know, we talked about education. Two things I'd like to mention. One, about a week ago, I was on vacation. I was in New Jersey. And I was wearing a T-shirt from the Oceanside Big Band and Jazz Festival, right here, that was held here in Winthrop, celebrating the centennial of Duke Ellington. And it had Duke Ellington's picture on it. And some guys just stopped me and said, "Hey, who's that on your T-shirt?" And I told them who it was. I said, "It's Duke Ellington." And these were young guys. Who's Duke Ellington? So to me, that's the scope of what we have to deal with. And when we talk about music education, that's part of the music education. Not just do we have to train people to be musicians, but we have to train people to know this music. Also, in line with the education point too, Duke Ellington was the first person to receive an honorary doctorate degree from Berklee College of Music. He also, Berklee makes no bones about hiding that Duke Ellington is a driving force behind the philosophy of education that they used to found Berklee College of Music. They don't try and hide that fact at all, that Duke Ellington had a lot to do with the foundation of the educational process there at Berklee College of Music.
Yeah, one thing that fascinated me about Duke when I read about him was that as opposed to composing sort of from the top down and have the musicians play that, he had ideas, but he would also write for the musicians that he had so that he was able to get the best out of his music given his personnel, and that he would combine instruments in different ways to make more specific sounds and so on. And I think that's an important factor to consider when you listen to Duke's music.
Well, I think you had two factors there. You have the one factor is just the sheer longevity, how long some of those musicians were associated with Duke, which gave him that luxury of being able to.
Right.
Harry Carney joined the band in 1927.
Right.
Was with the band till he died.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Hodges joined the band in 1928, except for three or four years in 1950s.
Yeah.
He was with the band the whole time.
Yeah, right.
And there were a number of other bands who band members who were with that band for that long period of time. So Duke had that longevity, which a lot of band leaders just don't have. You just don't know if that alto player is going to be with you. What kind of luxury was that to know that Johnny Hodges was going to be there
forever.
If you need an alto solo, you can call on Johnny Hodges. Yeah. My goodness.
Yeah, right. And as you mentioned those two names, I think, you know, Boston has the luxury of being able to say that both of them lived in Roxbury on Hammond Street, too far from each other.
Right.
And right around the corner from them was the tenor, why should I forget his name, Roland Hayes. He lived on Warwick Street. And it's amazing that, you know, we have this tradition that's right. I was talking to Roland Hayes' daughter. We worked together for a while at a school, and I was telling her about how Hodges and lived right there on the street. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, my father too lived right around the corner. So, I mean, these are traditions that Boston students should know about, you know, that there is this connection to, there is this rich tradition.
Strong cultural connection there.
Well, Roy Haynes is a Boston guy.
Oh, of course.
Roy Haynes.
And there are many, you know, too, we can, as we have noted with the giving honor to the Jazz Hall of Fame, the drummer who was with Miles Davis, Tony Williams.
Yeah. I used to play with Tony Williams' father, T. Williams, his tenor player. And the story was that when Connolly's, which was a jazz mecca at one time, young Tony Williams came in and Miles was playing, and Tony went backstage and said, I want to sit in. And Miles said, you better listen for a while. He said, the best thing you can do is listen right now. So I think Boston has a rich tradition of wonderful musicians. I recall playing down on Washington and Northampton, I guess it was, and you've got Sabby Lewis across the street at Big Jim's Shanty. You've got Louis Lounge right there in the corner. Washington. You go down up the street a little bit, you got Basin Street. You got at that time when I came to town, it became the Big M. You had Wally's, which had moved across the street. So there were a variety of places right in the black community where one could really become musically educated, and where young people could go and hear the music being played by traveling musicians coming through town.
Didn't the Carringtons come from that same area?
With Carrington, Terry Lynn and
her father.
Her father was playing here, I guess, in the 50s and 60s. But her grandfather must have been playing here, because her grandfather was also a drummer named Matthew Carrington. And I've heard that all three generations of Carringtons played at one time or the other at Sandy's jazz revival up in Beverly.
I remember Sandy's,
I heard all three of them played it. But the Ellington Band also contributed something else, or New England also contributed something else to the Ellington Band. Tom Whaley was Duke Ellington's copyist from about 1941. Well, roughly, I think he was with the band about the same period that Billy Strayhorn was with the band.
Right.
And he was the copyist. He did a lot of the work, actually, on the sacred concerts, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. He was from Boston. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, a lot of the early history that I found about Boston I found from Tom Whaley. Mm-hmm. He writes about the Boston jazz scene 1918 and before. So that he gives us an interesting picture. Mm-hmm. But he was a big part of the Ellington band, though not a name that most of us are going to know if you say, oh, Tom Whaley was associated with Duke. Yeah. We're not going to know that name, but he was a big part
of it. In fact, he was one of the ones whose signature I got. I didn't know who he was when I went to get his signature, because I didn't see him performing with the band. In fact, even afterwards, I never knew exactly who he was until I read some books and as I tried
but you,
to.
But you got the signature
the
anyway, just yeah, to, just in case.
I knew he came with the group, so he must have had some
important. Yeah, something, right?
You know. Yeah, but it's interesting.
You bring up a question by raising this gentleman's name, and that is Billy Strayhorn. Billy Strayhorn gets a lot of credit for his contributions to Duke's music and so on. But it seems to me it goes beyond that. It seems to me, and this is just my own speculation, that there was a real spiritual bond between Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington mm-hmm. and their compositions, because in the Sacred Concert, when they talked about these first six notes of In the Beginning mm-hmm. God, and four of the six notes were the same, that there's something there that's a little bit hard to talk about or to figure out, but what's your guess on that, or what's your take on that?
I just figure they were just musically attuned. Uh-huh. You know, I think Strayhorn understood what Ellington wanted, uh-huh. and so he was able to sort of think in an Ellingtonian mode yeah. while still retaining his own personality.
Yeah.
But when you hear Strayhorn playing outside the Ellington band, you do realize that there was a Strayhorn without Ellington.
Oh, I see.
So I think that the genius of Strayhorn was he was working for someone.
I see.
He was working for a genius, right. and the genius said, "This is what I need."
Uh-huh.
And the genius of Strayhorn was that he was able to do it and do it so well that many people can't tell that, oh, this is a Strayhorn composition, or this is a Strayhorn arrangement, or this is Strayhorn playing the piano on this right. piece, and not Duke. Yeah.
So, like, you could take those hats, change those hats perfectly. They were a perfect fit for him.
You know? He did the job. He did the job superbly that he was asked to do.
Well, it's interesting when you think about writing teams and so forth, and this is a special writing team, because I don't know enough about the two of them to be able to separate. I just sort of take it whole, get
right,
take the whole
right.
thing in. You know?
I think a lot of people did. I used to use the term Ellingtonia, mm-hmm. and I would sort of encompass both yeah. in that. And then at some point I decided that I needed to make sure Billy Strayhorn got his due.
Uh-huh. Right.
So I decided to try and differentiate between uh-huh. Strayhorn and Ellington, yeah. just to make sure that Strayhorn gets his propers.
Have you run some programs or where you just focus on Strayhorn issues? Because I
don't know if I've ever done programs focusing on Strayhorn or not. To tell you the truth, I don't think I have. I certainly have done a ton of programs focusing on different aspects of Ellington,
but
I don't know if I've ever done one focusing on Strayhorn or not. Yeah.
Interestingly, there was one album that Duke did. I was in his discography in the end, where all of the pieces were by Strayhorn. I forget which one that is, but
and
I
his mother called him Bill. Is that it? And his mother called him Bill.
It might be. I didn't find it right there, but mm-hmm. yeah, that was quite a collaboration. And a number of so many works that he did. I mean, we know of some that he did, like, you know, Take the Air Train and of course Lush Life. But he collaborated with many. Mm-hmm. The composition, so mm-hmm. they worked together for quite some time.
I think what's miraculous too is that Billy Strayhorn wrote Lush Life when he was a teenager.
Oh yeah. Oh.
You just think of the lyrics.
And the chords,
As a teenager, this is what he's writing. Huh. Distant gay places?
Yeah.
Who's thinking like that as a teenager? Remarkable.
He was quite a not just a musician, but a poet in a sense, the way he put those words together. You know?
Yeah, and he also, of course, became a kind of big brother to Lena Horne. Lena credits Billy Strayhorn with being a guiding force through the music business, and she said he was like a big brother to him. So,
What I found interesting, just going back a little bit, was that the longevity of the Ellington band and the Ellington enterprise was based on his ability to support financially the musicians going along, because oftentimes, even right now, there are some jobs you get as a band leader, and in order to get the best musicians, you almost have to take no money yourself.
Yeah.
When you get, you know, you have to split it up enough so that the musicians get a good piece of it. But if you're the band leader, you might have to take a short or no money sometimes. And it sounds like Duke knew that writing his sheet music and his piano this and that and piano music was a way to support what he needed to do. He was his own perpetual supporter and fundraiser, if you will.
Oh, it definitely kept the band surviving. I don't think there's any doubt that his band wouldn't have been able to survive mm-hmm. if it wasn't for There were still people who grumbled in the band mm-hmm. about salary. I guess that's mm-hmm. true any job, anywhere, yeah. anytime. But there were people who grumbled about salary mm-hmm. in the band. But in the truth to be told is that Duke was actually taking money from his royalties
yeah.
in order to keep that band playing and keep that band on the road. So
well, the band was his instrument.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No doubt.
I was reading somewhere where there was a period in time when Paul Gonzalez wasn't able to perform with the group for illness or whatever. And he said he continued to pay him, I think, for almost a whole year, even though he wasn't performing. Mm-hmm. It's that's how much he respected him and mm-hmm. wanted him to stay with the group.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I had read where he paid him out of his royalties that he was getting.
Yeah. Well, you think about that. I mean, that's, you know, all of us who have quote normal job.
Yeah.
That's what we hope our job will do. That we'll have some yeah. sort of medical yeah. benefits yeah. Yeah. that'll take care of us. Mm-hmm. But most musicians
right.
don't have that.
Yeah.
So if Duke was doing something like that, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But it also shows the value that Paul Gonzalez. I've heard of Miles Davis doing the same thing with the drummer Al Foster, but it was for more selfish reasons. Miles said, "That's my drummer. Uh-huh. I don't want him playing with
right.
anybody else."
Yeah.
So Miles paid him to yeah. not play with anybody yeah. else for yeah. a while.
If I want him to be my drummer, I'm
right.
provide
right. right.
gig bread. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Very interesting. Well, I move this discussion along and ask, I think, what is a critical question, and that is, how do you imagine the great musicians playing with Duke Ellington, who in some respects were shortchanged in terms of individual fame and notoriety because they were part of Duke's band and they were not heading up their own labels or heading up their own recordings and names with the leadership out of them. I mean, they weren't a Coltrane or they weren't like a Benny Goodman, that kind of thing. And I'm thinking about Johnny Hodges and some of the other people who were great musicians, but were sort of, I don't want to use the word relegated because I don't think you're relegated to Duke Ellington's band, but there is, you know, but there is in many musicians the need to go up front and to stand out, and especially if you're a great musician and you mm-hmm. know you are. How would you think those folks were able to carry that out in their own minds, sitting in the section and getting a solo here and there? Some of the great players in that band didn't get a lot of solo time, you know. Bob, you got any ideas on that? What's that?
When you ask that question, I think immediately of certain players that I've heard that could have probably done something like that. I think of Cat, for example.
Yeah, Cat Anderson.
Cat Anderson.
Yeah.
I mean, Cat Anderson, I mean, he could play some of the highest and most beautiful sounds mm-hmm. when he was playing high.
Yeah.
Some trumpet players play very high, mm-hmm. and they don't sound as pretty as that. I had a friend that did that, and he just passed away last week, I guess, with Leon Murrian, who had the ability to play those beautiful high notes really high and pretty,
mm-hmm.
and Cat could.
Oh, yeah.
He could go higher than anybody else. And I often think that, you know, if he sort of, he seemed like he could have done that. Mm-hmm. He could have formed his own band almost because of that fame. That high note fame, like Maynard or
yeah, yeah, even before Maynard.
Yeah,
it's a, you know, the music business, however, though, is a fickle business, and it may be that some of those guys just didn't want to have to deal with the world being a leader. It is a whole different kind of world. You know, you've got different responsibilities. And there's some of those guys who just might have said, look, yeah. I just want to come to work
right.
and play the gig, just like us, you know.
Right.
I don't want to be the manager.
Yeah.
I just want to be,
yeah.
be on the gig.
Some of Duke's men did, like Johnny Hodges, you know, he formed his own group from time to time and did a number of recordings. In fact, there was one recording that he did with his own group where he had Duke as a guest, you know.
Right.
So
yeah.
Some of them did of the musicians did perform, and his son Ellington Mercer.
Mercer. Yeah.
It's interesting how his son had a band way back in the 30s. He said, "Well, how old was Duke?" You know, Duke had his band, you know, at the same time, and Ellington Mercer also was performing. And then I think it was in the 60s when he really got with him. I read where Mercer had said he joined the band because he was his father's fashion designer. He said he would pick out his clothes. He said, "We're going to keep him looking like a Duke," you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's interesting that.
I had the good pleasure of going home one year. My father said to me, "We're going to go to a barbecue on Sunday, cookout on Sunday." And turns out the cookout was at the house of Roscoe Gill, who, if you look at the back of this Sacred Concerts, Roscoe Gill is listed as the special assistant to Duke Ellington on the Sacred Concerts. Roscoe was part of a Philadelphia production of the Sacred Concerts there. Devon Gardner is also featured on one of the Sacred Concerts as the vocalist. She was the featured soloist. I have a tape of this performance. But anyway, I went to this cookout. Mercer Ellington was there. Roscoe Gill was there. Devon Gardner was there. Eric Lewis, the piano player that's been playing with Wynton Marsalis, was there. Leon Bates, the classical pianist, was there. What's her name? I can't even remember her first name. I don't know if I ever knew her name. The group Sister Sledge that did the popular song We Are Family, one of them was there. And they're all sitting around in the living room telling stories and playing music, just playing music, talking about their life on the road, and just just absolutely amazing just to hear Mercer talking about, "Oh, my father did so and so," and at some, and then you hear this Sister Sledge play a tape of them doing Ellington songs.
Wow.
You know, it's like, where did this come from?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just a wonderful wonderful afternoon in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You remind me of when you said Bates. This guy has done the finest version of the Gershwin Concerto in F. Have you heard it? Ever heard him do it?
No.
Incredible player. And then you just reminded me
that
name. I didn't think of it for a long time.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I think we're going to slide to a close if we can. I'm excited. Right now, I'm very excited that we were able to come together this morning and talk about this wonderful man and his music and all of the other things that are part and parcel of this era. And I'm sort of struck by his ability to be creative over a period of years in the face of all of the obstacles. I mean, we're talking about a time when a black musician was really relegated to, I was going to say second class, but it's a lower class than that, where playing clubs and not being allowed to be part of the clientele, where it's told that Duke would rent train cars so that his musicians didn't have to deal with segregation in the hotels, where in many cases during Prohibition, when gangsters ran some of the places where he played and were really the people who called the shots, and how with all of that he had the resiliency and the strength to stay true to his convictions and do what he needed to do in spite of that. And there's only one, I think, answer as far as I'm concerned. And when Duke was asked about his success and all that and God, and someone said, besides God, what is important to your success? He said, "There is no besides God." What do you mean, besides God? He said, "You have to have that sense of spiritual commitment, and you got to have the faith that there's something there that's larger than all of us in order to proceed in the way we have."
Just I was just about to read that very same quote you just said, but Duke later he thought it was such a stupid question.
Yeah.
He later followed that. He says, besides God, how does one manage without God? Then he said, the only reason an interviewer sometimes asks the interviewer stupid questions is because the interviewer thinks the interviewee is stupid. So he really thought that was a stupid question to ask.
Yeah,
it
right.
says something about what he thought about the question of God. You know, it says not besides God, but it's because of God.
Because of God, yes. Yeah.
And that certainly ties in where the sacred concert fit into his whole
way of thinking. I want to thank our guests for coming this morning, spending time with us. Eric Jackson, as I said, the man you should listen to if you want to know about what's going on here. I think that if I were doing a music program, my assignment would be listen to Eric Jackson and write a reaction paper. and you'll know what's going on in the world. Bob Tyler, my big brother and mentor of sorts and colleague, we play together. Every chance we get, I have to nail him down early because he has so many things going on and a very popular player. Thank you, Bob.
And thank you Murph, for inviting me.
new friend of mine now, Murph
yeah.
Lewis, the man who was there, the man who had Duke's arms around him, and that's got to be a special feeling for you.
Yes.
Any concluding or closing ideas that? Anything you'd like to leave with the audience?
Just come hear the music.
Come hear the music. Yeah. Let me give you that information once more. The Sacred Concert, featuring Ken Hadley's big band, Paul Broadnax, Eula Lawrence, and Monica Hatch, will be vocalists on that show, along with a 50-voice adult choir, and that's Saturday, November 4th, at St. John's Church Parish. On Winthrop Street in Winthrop. Thank you for watching.